ようこみましょうへようこそ。
Hi, I'm Jason Crane, and I'm here again with Yoko Miwa. Hi, Yoko.
Hi, Jason.
And on the last show, which was actually very, very recently, we're doing a special episode today for reasons that will quickly become obvious. But on the last show, we talked about your upcoming show at Scullers on November 19th. Scullers, of course, one of the landmark jazz clubs in the country. But before Scullers, there were other landmark jazz clubs, and it turns out that one guy was involved in quite a number of them and in bringing us a lot of the most storied jazz performances in the history of our music. And that guy is joining you now. Will you introduce your guest?
He is Fred Taylor. Fred Taylor.
Hi, Fred.
Well, nice to be here and meet you audio wise.
That's right. Due to technology, now we can meet without ever meeting. Fred, you've been a part of the East Coast jazz scene for a very long time, and a part of at least three seminal institutions in the jazz world, in the modern day Scullers, but going back further than that, Paul's Mall and the Jazz Workshop. And before I really want to, of course, talk about those two places, but I'm curious, how did you first get introduced to improvised music?
Well, it's, you know, everything. I never had planned to be in the music business. And when I graduated Boston University, I actually went to work with in the Serta Mattress Company. And for 9 years, I actually was working with Serta, but at night I was hanging out, and that was in the 50s. And Boston in the 50s, by the way, was a really roaring town. The corner of Mass Avenue in Columbus, there was the Hi-Hat, which was the big club. It had, you know, Sarah Vaughan and
there are some Charlie Parker recordings that were made at the Hi-Hat, for
example. Yeah, Charlie Parker. I mean, that was a famous place. And then up the street was Wally's Paradise, the Savoy, the Big M. Across the street was Club Eddie's, which was upstairs. Then around the corner was Estelle's, and then there was an alley and a famous after hours club called the Pioneer Club, which was kind of legendary.
So that sounds kind of like Boston's 52nd Street almost.
You know what? I used that exact same reference. I said it was like Boston's version of the 52nd Street. And then there was even, you go a few blocks down to Washington Street on Mass Avenue. There was Basin Street South, which was kind of a big club. And then Louis Lounge and Big Jim Mellon's. I mean, I'm telling you something, the 50s was really roaring in Boston. But I was kind of known. I used to do, I had, when tape recorders first came in, I thought it was the greatest thing in the world. And I bought one of the first tape recorders, a Revere. And I was running around at night recording things in the clubs.
And these were big, big units, right, Fred? The big machines. These were.
No. The first one, the Revere, was like a little suitcase.
Oh, okay.
A 5-inch reel, traveled 3¾ IPS, and it had a speaker so you could play back right in the machine.
Oh, wow.
It was a pretty good little machine, and then about a year or two later, they came up with a bigger model. Another company, and I bought it, was a tape deck. Had 7-inch reel, and now we were up to 7.5 IPS. And I bought a real professional microphone, and I was running around doing a lot of recording. But because of that, a fellow that I – and Storyville was going – during this period. And a friend of mine, John Stukas, who I kind of got to know via Storyville, called me, said, "Hey, listen, I found this jazz organist. He's incredible. He and a drummer, they sound like the whole Basie band out at Jackie's Game Bar in Lynn. Would you come out and record him?" So I went out, and that was a fellow named Joe Bucci on a Hammond B3. And at the end of the week, I said, "Well, John G, you owe me a little something." And he did what I call the famous, the "I ain't got no money" shuffle, where you go back and forth from one foot to the other. So so I said, "Well, all right, listen, I'll make a deal with you. This guy is really fabulous. Let's go, we'll work together and see if we can promote him." That was my entrance into the music business, and I never looked back after that.
Wow. So how long after that moment did you make the music business your full-time life?
Well, it became from that moment on, I forgot to look for work. Yeah. I mean, because we got involved, I was recording Joe. We were booking, then started booking him into different places. And I met a great guy named Al Corey, who was the Capitol Records promotion guy. And I showed him the Bucci thing. And I said, "You know, we do a thing. It could be Bucci plays Basie." So he loved it. And I gave him a demo reel. He took it, and Capitol loved it. And we signed Joe to Capitol. And there's a fabulous LP that came out called Wild About Basie. And it just kept going. And then one thing would lead to another. And eventually, 1963, the Jazz Workshop on Boylston Street opened. And that was actually the new Jazz Workshop. The original Jazz Workshop was in a bar called the Stables, which was right near Copley Square on Huntington Avenue. That was the original. It was sort of down, there was a little ramp at the end of the bar, went down, and there was a room. And that was really the very original Jazz Workshop. Mm. Herb Pomeroy and people like Arif Mardin, who was going to Berkeley at those years. But the fellow Harold Buckhalter, who owned the Stables, had to move all his clubs and licenses because of the Mass Turnpike was taking some of that land over.
Oh, okay.
And that's why he moved everything over to the Boylston Street by across from the Hotel Lenox, that area. And he asked me if I would help with promoting and help Vardy Haritunian, who was one of this great sax player, but who was trying to do some of the booking. So that's how I started the involvement with the Jazz Workshop. So our very first act at the new club was Stan Getz.
Wow.
And Ray Santisi was on piano. And matter of fact, Yoko has actually taken over. Ray passed about a year or so ago. And Yoko has occupied Ray's teaching studio now at Berkeley.
That's right.
And so Ray Santisi, John Neves was the bass player. Pete LaRocca was on drums, and Herb Pomeroy. And then Stan Getz was the special guest.
So, Fred, I have to interrupt you there to say you are naming exactly a band that you saw 50 years ago. I've seen bands last week, and I can't exactly remember who was playing.
You know, I couldn't remember last week either, but that was so, I mean, you know, that was an indelible beginning.
Sure.
You know, there's certain things. Now, if you move to who played the next week, I'm not sure. I have to look at some of my records, but that I do remember.
And did the crowds turn out right from the beginning in the new location?
Yeah. But jazz is an up and down battle. It has never become the great audience
kind of attraction.
Attraction.
Yeah.
But it is probably the root of all the music that gets produced. The basics of jazz. Matter of fact, I remember when the rock invasion started and the Beatles and that whole wave, jazz musicians were in the studios recording the rock. They were a lot of the basics of the rock recordings were jazz musicians.
Yeah, and nothing has changed. I mean, I work, my day job is I'm a DJ at a rock radio station, and so many of my friends from the jazz world are the musicians of the bands that I play during my rock radio job. I mean, it's the same, you know, they can play anything, so they end up going anywhere.
Yeah. Right. So about a year later, Harold Buchalter, who built this club, opened up right next door. There was a mall, an actual walkway that led to the next room, which he created Paul's Mall. And then I immediately was, you know, had to take over the booking and the advertising and the production. As a matter of fact, I was both the sound and light and booker and advertiser and janitor and wore every hat. And by the way, we opened Paul's Mall with Henny Youngman.
Oh my gosh, the Take My Wife Please one-liner guy.
Exactly right. And about 6 months later, we actually took over and both in more or less sort of like the ownership and operation of the workshop and the mall. I had a partner named Tony Mariello, who had run a club called the Starlight. It was on Harvard Street in Alston, and where Joe Bucci had played, and I had met Tony, and he was looking to do something, so he became a partner. And so from about June of 65 on, we ran the Paul's Mall and the Jazz Workshop until 1968.
Now, Fred, I've always wondered, your name is Fred and the other guy's name is Harold. Where does Paul's Mall come from?
Okay, that's a good question. When Paul's Mall opened, Harold, who was the owner, brought a fellow named Paul Vallon, who was a very gregarious pianist who played in a lot of played in a lounge that Harold owned. So he brought Paul down to be the manager, and it was at the very beginning. So he used Paul, and that the place itself was a mall that you got into. So that's it. Kind of got created as the name as Paul's Mall. Wow.
Gotcha.
But he disappeared about 6 months later,
and the name stuck.
I think he was a little too heavily invested in some of our four-legged friends.
Gotcha.
I want you to talk about a little bit of the interesting stories, like you're responsible for bringing Miles Davis to Boston, you know.
1967 there was a wonderful, matter of fact, I he's really the unsung hero, and nobody ever mentions him. His name is Jack Whittemore. He was a booker in New York who really, his roster, Miles Davis, Art Blakey, Roland Kirk. I mean, he was unbelievable. And if there was a problem at 10 o'clock at night, you could call Jack and he'd respond and he'd solve it. And I'll tell you, he was one of the first really great jazz bookers. So around 1967, we said, you know, how about maybe we could bring Miles to Boston? And that's when we started in, I forget what month it was, but in 1967. And then from that time on, I was the only one Miles would play for in Boston. And every year, I think We played every year until he kind of just left the business for a while. And about 5 years later, I got a phone call from Miles that says, you know, I got a great band. We're coming back. And he was going to do a – George Wein was going to present him at Avery Fisher Hall, and he wanted to warm up. And that's when I because I didn't have the – our clubs had closed in 78, and this was 81. Yeah. And I had found this little place in Kenmore Square called Kix. And it was a disco up front, but in the rear was a club that hadn't been used for years. So I made a deal with the owner to take it over, and we set it up, and Miles came in. We did four nights. The first night was unbelievable. Mm. The press from all over the world was there, Japan, wow. France, London. Wow. It was just unbelievable. Wow. So that was – then I worked with Miles then from 81 until the day he died, I worked with him.
Wow. And, Fred, was that – was the reason that Miles would play for you and that all of these other artists worked with you, was it a lot of it about building relationships?
Oh, absolutely. I think one of the things that maybe differentiates me a little bit from some others, I was a bit of a musician myself. I studied piano when I was 11 years old with a very famous Madame Shaloff. Matter of fact, one of her sons was Serge Shaloff.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, who was the great baritone player with Woody Herman, the Four Brothers. And I then later studied a little bit of stride piano, and I played a little bit of trumpet, and I ended up playing a little bit of cocktail drum. So I was a sort of a half-baked musician. It gave me the understanding of what musicians needed and wanted. And, you know, then I became a club owner. And then the whole involvement of booking. And then I became a promoter and producer of concerts. And then I was an advertising man and a public relations man. So all those pieces kind of go to where you have a real relationship with an artist because you got a lot of things to talk about.
For sure. Are there some other highlights of your kind of early years as a club owner and booker that really stand out for you? You mentioned Stan Getz and then later on Miles. Are there some other things that kind of are stuck in your brain?
Well, we broke. We virtually broke practically every superstar that's out there today. Earth, Wind and Fire, Aerosmith, Billy Joel, Bruce Springsteen. These are all people that I started at Paul's Mall. And Lily Tomlin, Richard Pryor, Ace Trucking Company, Procter and Bergman. Oh my God. It was interesting. Paul's Mall was an eclectic mix of comedy, R&B, big bands. I played all the big bands, Duke Ellington, Woody Herman, Lionel Hampton. Oh God, just on. And, So we kind of did everything except hard rock.
Okay.
Seals and Crofts, we broke them. And something about those years that when these artists today come, for instance, Billy Joel played Fenway Park last summer. And the first words out of his mouth at Fenway Park, "Gee, Boston, I love it. You know, I got my start at a little club called Paul's Mall."
Wow.
The same thing happens when Bruce Springsteen comes in, and they all talk about how they started at Paul's Mall. 40 years later, still on their minds. The Earth, Wind & Fire did a show at the Wang theater about a year ago, and the Apple store on Boylston Street had made an arrangement to have the singers come over the next day and do a little like Q&A around noontime. So, of course, I heard about it. I went and I was sitting in the front chair, and the guys were up, and they said, you know, Boston is sort of a home for us because we really got our start here at this club just down the street from here called Paul's Mall. So I raised my hand, and Phil Bailey looks over. He says, Fred Taylor, oh, my God. And all the guys came off the stage, and we had a big hugging session.
Oh, that's fabulous.
I mean, so there was something that's just indelible about those years. And this is, you know, we're talking like the 70s, the early 70s, early and mid 70s.
And, so, you know, Fred, at the risk of embarrassing you, I mean, I think it speaks pretty highly to your open-mindedness as a booker that the list of people you just gave us, from, you know, edgy comedians to R&B to rock to jazz, all played under the same roof.
I'll give you one more, which is a mind blower. I had Jose Greco and his whole dance troupe.
Wow.
And I hired a basketball floor, and we put it in so that we could do the show.
So if we can kind of fast forward the years a little bit to the beginning of the Scullers era, how did your involvement there come about, Fred?
Yeah, well, originally that hotel opened, I think it was an Embassy Suites when it first was built. And by the way, where the location is the former site of the famous Coca-Cola bottling plant. And there was a famous sign that you could see from the Memorial Drive across the river, the Coca-Cola, and evidently that must sold. The building was demolished, and that's where the hotel now sits.
Okay.
Then it became a DoubleTree, and the general manager wanted to get some people coming into the place, get it known. So he wanted to have a little local jazz thing in the lounge. So they started with some local jazz, and Sue O'Clair was hired to do some publicity. Well, Sue O'Clair has been my publicist. Matter of fact, she started with me in 1981 with the Miles Date. And so things were going along, and it wasn't doing all that well. And Sue said, you know, you ought to talk to Fred Taylor. You know, he's ran all the clubs and blah, blah, and so forth. So I finally got a call. And I said, well, I'll try to help out a little, make some suggestions. So one day the manager, Mark Fallon, who, by the way, wonderful, wonderful guy, said, will you just take this damn thing over? I said, well, I hadn't really planned on it, but well, okay. So that's how I came into Scullers, not ever intending to have been in another club again. So that we started, and it's now 25 years later, and we really built it up. It was a little 40-seat overstuffed lounge, and I gradually got rid of the overstuffed chairs and got in the typical cafe chair, and we increased the capacity to about 100. And then I introduced ticketing, because originally it was just you came in and the waitress would give you a check, you know. So we started it as a really ticketed operation, and I designed the first website and set up the first online ticketing. And then I introduced food into the club, which they had never had. And then I came up with the dinner show package. I did all the marketing and advertising and booking. And that's how we've just – and then we had the major expansion in 1995 is when we expanded the room to its present size, which we now have about 170. And And as you go up in capacity, we were able to go up in the caliber of the artists that we were able to bring in.
And yeah, and I mean, everybody has played at Scullers at this point. I mean, I doubt there are too many names we could name since the club started who haven't been on its stage. And it seems like you still have a talent for finding people because, you know, I think of some of the people who had early, I don't know about their first, but certainly very early gigs and who went on to become very famous, like Diana Krall and Norah Jones and Jamie Cullum and, you know, lots of people who then became kind of household names, but who played at Scullers. So it seems like you still have a bit of the magic touch there, sir.
And Michael Bublé also.
Yeah.
He was kind of a wise guy. Michael was, but he certainly is a great singer. Yeah, no, we have been able to introduce a lot of, you know, a lot of artists. There's a young pianist named Yoko Miwa we kind of got going there, too.
I've heard of her.
Yeah.
She's pretty great.
I'll tell you, the business, though, has gotten a lot more difficult. There's a cultural change that has taken place in particular, I'd say, the last 5 years. And today, on a Wednesday and Thursday, it's almost impossible to run a 10 o'clock show. People, oh no, I'm too tired. I got to go to work tomorrow. And, you know, technology is killing us. We are on call with the phone 24 hours a day. People walk around, people go to lunch, they don't talk to each other. They're texting, they're looking at their emails on the phone. In the Paul Small Jazz Workshop days, the shows were 9 and 11, and then we'd go out for something to eat.
Right.
So there's been a tremendous change in people's lives, and it's really due to technology. And it's not all that good. But that's what we're faced with.
And Fred, I know that you're also we're getting an incredible distillation of this story, but I know that you're working on telling the entire story in printed form, right?
Right. I am. We're finally working on a book. I'm working with a wonderful writer named Richard Vacca, and who has a terrific book on the market right now called The Boston Jazz Chronicles from 1935 to 62. And how, by the way, the way this happened, I've been wanting to write a book for the last few years, and I never could find anybody that I could really, you know, get some continuity and really get it going. And Dick called me now, I guess about a year and a half ago, and he said, look, I'm wanted to talk to you about I'm going to write another book starting with 1962 to 95. So I said to him, I said, you know, now you're getting into my area. And I said, I've been trying to write a book, and would you consider working with me to help me write my book? Mm-hmm. So he thought about it for a minute. He says, yeah, you know, that would be great. So that's how we got together.
Perfect.
And we've been working on it now. We've been meeting every Saturday. We've had 14 sessions, about 3 to 4 hours each time. Wow. Recording and talking, and then he's been writing, transcribing, and distilling, and we're probably 6 to 8 months away from it happening.
Right.
Oh, that's very exciting. I can only imagine the number of stories that we're all going to get to hear in this book.
There are a lot of stories. It's a good thing. What he's done is he's made an index so that I have a sheet of all the things that I've covered, you know, just the the headline of the story. And God, we have covered a lot of ground.
I bet. Well, I'll definitely look forward to reading that when it comes out. We've been talking with Fred Taylor of Paul's Mall and the Jazz Workshop and Scullers and everything else having to do with Boston jazz, and also, of course, with Yoko. Fred, boy, what a pleasure to hear even a fraction of the stories. Thank you so much for taking the time to share these with us.
Well, it's a pleasure talking with you, and you keep your blogs going because that's important.
I certainly will. And Yoko, a pleasure to talk to you, and I hope everyone is busily purchasing their tickets for the November 19th show, because it always sells out, and we don't want anyone calling us on the 18th and saying, how come I can't get a ticket? The reason is because it always sells out. So don't wait. Get your tickets now.
Yeah, buy tickets now. And if you come to see me on November 19th, of course, Fred will be there. And I'm sure you can talk to him. You can hear more story, interesting, you know, history stories from him.
Fabulous. This is the Yoko Miwa Show. That's Yoko Miwa and Fred Taylor. Thank you both. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Jason.
Okay. Bye-bye.